An eerie, haunting little concoction from Led Zeppelin called No Quarter. We're talking with Preston Dennett about the book Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. And as my friend Nathan Staten points out to me, yes, I did say it's Preston's nudist book. That's a misspoken word there. I meant to say newest book, although a little alien nudity might help the book sales a little bit. There is no nudity in this book that I've found so far, but there are a lot of really interesting alien encounter stories. We're going to hear one more of those tales about an encounter that didn't go so well, and then we'll go to the phone lines with your calls, questions, comments, and stories. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Preston, it seems like the stories that you told are generally positive, that the net effect of these encounters, strange as they may be, is overall pretty good for people. Is that the general consensus of the stories, at least here, or is it the consensus in the wider research that you've done?
For the most part, yeah, I don't think it's a super negative experience necessarily. It can be very traumatic. But I don't have any accounts where ETs are coming to purposefully hurt people, purposefully scare them. There's no accounts of sadism or intentional torture or anything like this. That does not appear to be their agenda at all.
You do have the one story in the book about what you call flying saucer sickness. Tell us about that.
Yes, this guy did have a negative experience in some ways. I'm certainly the after effects were negative. He was a young paper boy. This is in a small town in Texas, and was going to deliver papers early one morning. This is around 4 a.m., and this object appears overhead. He was pretty familiar with planes at this point. He had always had an interest in them and was looking for, lights, like red and green lights, wing lights, strobes, anything to identify this thing, but it was just one big white light. And it comes down pretty low over his head. He couldn't tell quite how low, but he felt it was pretty low. And it's still dark at this point, mind you. And suddenly, this thing darts away, and it's no longer dark. It's light. He hasn't delivered any of his papers. About, an hour or two have passed. He's very confused, delivers the papers as fast as he can, and gets home. He's pretty tired. He's upset. His parents are upset. His boss is upset. He doesn't tell him what happened, because he doesn't quite understand it. He's thinking this wasn't a plane, but what could it possibly have been? The word UFO did not come to him. This is not what he's thinking. He just doesn't know. He goes to bed, which he normally would after, delivering the papers early in the morning. But in the days that followed, in the next week, he's trying to deliver papers and can't do it. He's just too weak. He ends up walking his bike home, falls asleep, and this sort of a deterioration of his condition continued. He became so weak he couldn't get out of bed, and they rushed him off to the hospital. They were not able to diagnose him at the hospital, gave him a bunch of vitamins, and pretty much kept him there and then sent him home. But he attributes this directly to this incident that he had, because that's when it started. And he remained, bedridden basically for 3 months, just too weak to get out of bed. Had to be excused from school, from physical activities. Lost a lot of friends because of it. Totally changed his life. And it turns out that's not the only experience he's had that's unusual. He started later in life having nightmares of these small figures in his bedroom. He recalled as a young kid seeing this bald figure outside his second-story bedroom, screamed. His sisters came running in, so they verified this incident. Became kind of a family mythology. Who was that, bald man with the weird eyes outside, this guy's window? So he finally ends up going under hypnosis. There's only two cases involving hypnosis in the book. I totally support hypnosis. I think it works. I think there's evidence of that. But you can pretty much remove any explanations of false memory syndrome or, confabulation or fantasizing this out of the picture, because a lot of people have fully conscious memories. Now, by this point, this guy has read a number of books on the subject, and he locates a guy to hypnotize him. The hypnotist basically says, since you've read so many books, you're recall will likely be contaminated. But he goes ahead with it anyway and does recall a very typical abduction, I guess you would call it, examination by gray-type ETs, except they're not gray. He says they don't look like your typical gray really at all. They're taller, yellower skin. Some have a greenish skin to them. And he said the experience was overall very scary. He says it was, in fact, so terrifying he kept passing out throughout the entire onboard segment. But ultimately, he comes away from this experience changed. And like a number of witnesses, he starts becoming interested in alternative areas. This is something I found again and again. I mean, one guy came away from his experience as a psychic reader. Another, you know, this sort of thing. He came away from his experience very interested in hands-on healing and, you know, Reiki, this kind of thing. So that's another weird pattern I see, and I attribute it to their experience.
I have a bunch of other questions, but there are several folks holding on the phone, so maybe we'll take a couple of calls, and I'll weave my questions in with what comes in from the callers. First-time caller, Joseph in Sherman Oaks. Hi, Joseph. You're on with Preston Dennett.
Yes, hi. I'd like to confirm with your guest that, yes, they do appear in Woodland Hills. I had experience in Reseda, California, with one. He was green, 5'6". He showed me, he put something in my right ear. My ears popped open, and I heard other people. And the odd thing, he got really scared from the TV set. He got really scared, and I saw his foot. Both his feet was covered with tree leaves, both of them. And then he didn't like just cross the room. He used the wall from point A to B, B to C, C to D. That's how he moved.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Does that fit, Preston, with the story that you know about Woodland Hills?
Well, I've got a number of cases from that area.
Okay.
Close to the Topanga Canyon, whole hot spot there.
Joseph, thanks for sharing that with us. We're going to go east of the Rockies, where one of the guys who's mentioned in your book, Preston, is calling in. This is Kevin. Hi, Kevin.
George Knapp, it's a pleasure to talk to you. You're a highly respected person in this field, and I'm glad I get to talk to you.
In some circles, I am. Anyway, so you're Kevin.
Yes, sir.
Tell us the story.
The Corman in the very first story of the book.
And is it as Preston has told the story here tonight, is that accurate? That's what happened to you?
Most of it is. There's a couple of minor details that he's got that are different in the book than what my actual story was. But look, George, when's the last time anybody asked you if you'd like to, you know, meet an extraterrestrial?
That doesn't happen very often.
That's correct. Yeah, and I'll tell you right now, if it ever does, tell them no.
Why is that? Has it been negative for you, for your life?
To me, it was everything you know about reality. Just throw it out the window, because we don't know anything about reality compared to the real reality that is out there. It's one thing to watch the Twilight Zone. It's another to live it.
So are there lingering effects? I mean, is it something that permeates your thoughts all the time?
Yes. Yes, it does. I'm still trying to figure it out, what it all means. I started researching this subject back 34 years ago. This happened in 1982. So, of course, I started researching this whole subject, the whole extraterrestrial phenomenon, and it's all tied in with the supernatural forces that are out there that permeate this universe. And there's so many different threads to the whole thing. And I'm talking about ghosts, and I'm talking about orbs, and I'm talking about Bigfoot. There's that many threads, and they are. And you know this field as well as I do. It's wide open to anything.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned all those other threads. Have you had other experiences that would not qualify as a UFO, but certainly would qualify as something in the paranormal realm?
Yes. Yes, I have.
But you want to tell us?
That's a whole different subject. That'd be a whole different. That'd be a show by itself going into that with you, George.
Let me ask you, Preston, while Kevin is on the phone, is that kind of a normal thing that people who have UFO experiences report other kinds of weird stuff?
I wouldn't say it's normal, but it's certainly not uncommon. Something I noticed quite a bit, particularly with people who have extensive experiences. I will often report, out-of-body experiences or precognition or psychic events of various types. And definitely Bigfoot does turn up, not a whole lot. Actually, very rarely, but it does happen.
So, Kevin, let me ask you one last question. I mean, do you tell people, do you share this openly with people, and do they think you're crazy, or do you kind of keep your cards close to the vest?
George, I try to tell anybody and everybody that will listen, because everybody has the right to know the truth. And one thing that is true is this. The government is hiding a lot of facts on it. They've got a lot to hide, and they've got a lot of reasons for hiding it.
And how do you know that?
I believe I have an implant in my forehead, and I've been getting downloaded information, I guess, because I just happen to know a lot of things. And there's a lot of things that are going to happen here within the next year and a half. And it all ties into biblical prophecy in the book of Revelation in the Bible.
All right. Well, I appreciate you calling in. I think that's a pretty interesting story. And maybe we'll have to get in touch with you off the air and continue the conversation. But, Kevin, thank you for calling in. We're going to go west of the Rockies now to Howard in Vancouver. Hi, Howard. What's on your mind?
Hello, George and Preston. I thought this would be a good time to tell you guys about an experience that I had about 50 years ago when I was in the Army. At that time, I was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. And we were getting ready to get sent out over to Germany. At that time, they had the Czechoslovakian crisis going on, so we were going through some very extensive training and exercises at the time. I was a tank driver then, and this particular night, we were out in the prairie out there, and we were lined up. We were playing war games. We were lined up behind a ridge line, and we were supposed to assault this other unit that was on the other side of the ridge down the hill, and we had quietly moved in behind this ridge, and we're waiting on, and I was a driver then. I was sitting in the front of the vehicle, and so my view was kind of limited where I was, but this bright light came up from behind us. It was kind of, I didn't see it. It came up on our left, and I didn't see it until it was directly to my left. But it was just a round, bright, white light, kind of maybe a little greenish tint to it. And it had a halo around it. And it was just moving very slowly, maybe about 30 miles an hour, just cruised by on our left side and just made a straight line over the ridge. I remember... I thought the halo was from my goggles, a refraction or something. I lifted my goggles up, and the halo was still there. So I knew that what I was looking at was real, and I got on the hit the switch for the intercom and asked the tank commander. Had kind of a grouchy sergeant, didn't take up, put up with too much nonsense. Anyway, I said, did you see that? And right away he says, that was a helicopter. He says, don't get any ideas about any little green men or anything. And instantly he told me everything I needed to know. He saw it and he thought it was weird. He wasn't going to admit it. But at any rate, I was puzzling about that. About 5 minutes later, we got the order to move out. We crested the hill. Came roaring down the side towards this, down the hillside towards this unit at the bottom. And we got the order to, or he gave me the order to simulate firing. And now, when you simulated firing, all you did is flash the headlights. And in those combat vehicles, you had a blackout lock switch. And it's a triangular shaped affair on your instrument panel. It has one lever up, three down, and all you had to do was just use your thumb and pull the lock lever back and flip it up with your index finger. I'd done it 1,000 times. It was simple. But this particular time, this thing was just seemed to be jammed. Nothing. I couldn't move it. And the sergeant was yelling at me. He was calling me names that I had never heard before, you know. And I took both hands off the steering bar, and I was wrestling with this thing. It was like it was welded in place. I couldn't budge it. And, you know, and he, finally the exercise was over, and we parked and dismounted. He wouldn't even talk to me. And we walked, we had to go to a debriefing tent, you know, and got there and had our company commander in there, was just mad as a hornet. And it dawned on me that nobody else was flashing their lights either. You know, nobody did. And I asked the guy next to me, did your switch get stuck? And he says, yeah, you know, can't figure it out. And of course, you know, all of these enlisted men, nobody was going to, you know, tell this red-faced, fire-breathing captain, you know, that the switch got stuck, you know. He wasn't going to buy that, but we just all kept our mouths shut about it.
But so you think that this craft, whatever it was, that it interfered with the switch?
I think they interpreted that as some kind of an aggressive action, and they locked our switches.
You know, you hear about these cases involving, like, nuclear missiles, things of that sort, and fire planes that get their radar and other and weapon systems jammed, so it sort of fits the larger narrative.
That's what I was thinking. It took me while I had to think it over a little bit to put two and two together, because there was a lot of stuff going on there at the time, you know, but I thought about it later, and, you know, that had to be what they were doing.
Howard, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Preston, when you have military personnel involved, it seems just more a little bit added credibility, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think a person's profession does add to the credibility when Project Blue Book was in force.
You have a chapter in your book about an encounter on a Navy ship. We're going to go to a break here, so it's not time to tell the whole story, but you have the guy's name, Jim Kubelbeck. Is that his real name?
Yes, it is. He, like about half the witnesses in the book, allowed his name to be used. He's a Navy electronics expert, part of the Submarine Hunter Squadron. You know, pretty great witness, really.
We're talking with Preston Dennett about his newest book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. We'll be going to a break, and then a lot of folks are on the phones. We'll get back to as many of your calls, questions, and comments as we can. A little band called the Beatles take us into the break. One of our listeners sent me a link to this song. I thought it was perfect for a coast, post-apocalyptic truck driving song. That's Bill Kirchen, Truck Stop at the End of the World. Thanks, Gary, for sending that. We're talking with Preston Dennett about Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact, his latest book. And the phone line's pretty full. We'll get to as many of your calls, comments, and questions as we can in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM coming up. Our final segment with Preston Dennett about his book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. We're going to the wildcard line, Jeff in Culver City. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
Hi, George and Mr. Preston Bennett. Yes, when it comes to these UFOs, I've been perplexed at how sophisticated the designs are and, you know, totally amazed at the construction of some of these crafts, many of which are vast in dimensional size, stretching, you know, in many instances, several miles long. You know, it's said that many of these crafts resemble floating cities. My question is, Mr. Bennett, if these enormously gigantic spacecrafts are primarily being utilized to, quote unquote, study our way of life here on Earth and used for nothing more than merely observational purposes, then why hasn't our premier space exploration agencies like NASA, SpaceX, and others been able to fully gauge these alien beings' real, true purposes for these visitations? And what is the real reason why the space station is in existence? You know, I don't believe it's just they're up there doing sampling and just trying to see what the stars are made of. And I'll take care of stuff. Yeah.
Jeff, you're so cynical. Thanks.
Yeah, well, these are big questions. I mean, NASA, I think, is probably neck deep in this subject. I have no doubt they're covering up information. This is certainly not a new thing. my understanding is they've been talking about the subject for quite some time, recently announcing new planets and things like this. They recently made an announcement that in about 20 years we should have evidence of alien life. I think if you read between the lines, what they're saying is, you know, by that time we're going to release a little bit of what we already know. And as far as, you know, these super large ships, the ET technology is mind-blowing. It's something that's always bothered me is the wide variety of UFOs seen. There's not a whole lot of consistency there. I mean, you do get the saucer shapes and, you know, colored lights, but there are so many different shapes, and these things can get absolutely mind-blowingly large.
Well, it's weird, too, that they can appear small and get larger, as you describe in some of the encounters in your book. What looks small suddenly gets a lot bigger. It's like shape-shifting.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre. There's a case investigated by Leonard Stringfield in which a guy was taken to photograph the interior of a UFO, and it's much larger on the inside than it is on the outside, which is something a number of witnesses have reported as well. So these guys can control, I mean, if they're stopping time or going back in time, that makes sense that they're controlling space as well. Space and time are intricately connected.
It's like the first case we discussed in your book, this gigantic thing larger than a Navy ship is right next to it, and only the key witnesses are able to see it. The other people seem to not notice it. It's not picked up on instrumentation. It's weird.
Yeah. He asked them about that, and they said that they have the ability to do that, and this is something I've seen in other cases as well. People who should be seeing these objects aren't seeing them for whatever reason. I think it is something that's imposed upon them by the UFO occupants.
Well, if it's technology, it sure would be nice to have it. We're going to go to, thanks, Jeff, we're going to go to Sally in Bismarck, North Dakota. Hi, Sally, you're on Coast to Coast with Preston Dennett.
Well, hi there. I'm so surprised that I got in.
No problem. What's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you, I should have called this in a long time ago, feeling a little guilty about it. But I was living in Montana, and my husband and I had gone to an evening wedding. And it was in July, and all the stars in the night were just gorgeous. But we got home around 10 o'clock in the evening and put our little girl to bed. She was 10, actually. And out the bathroom window, I looked to the north. And that is where Malmstrom Air Force Base, Minot, I don't know. There were some Air Force bases north of that area. And I was watching small, vessels. And they were not acting normal. They were going straight up and down and then to the side and being kind of odd. And so then, okay, I thought, well, that's really weird, but who would I call? I didn't know who to call. So I went to bed. And then I couldn't sleep. So I went and looked out the picture window to the south, which is where the wheat fields are. And mind you, this is a very clear summer night. And I looked up and I saw, the only thing I can say is coming out of the fog clouds was a mothership. And her lights were subdued, and those lights that I saw flying over on the north side came back, and they kind of went right up to her on the inside. I say her. It's the ship, you know. I still didn't know who to call.
So did you call anybody?
No, and this was 1993, and I was young. You know, I was in my 20s, and I was just like, I should call somebody. I don't know who to call.
Media. Have you ever talked about it before?
Newspaper. Somebody's got to have seen that. Nobody
and did
saw
they?
It.
Did any? No one else saw it.
No one.
Have you ever talked about this before, Sally?
Well, let me just say that our place was 5 miles out of town, and there wasn't really much around us. Okay, what was your question?
I think we wanted to just to hear your story, so thank you for sharing it with us. Preston, I think this sort of reflects something that comes up again and again. People tell a story. If there's not another witness, there's no photo, no video, what do you do with it?
Yeah, it's a problem. You know, this is, I'm going to say that probably 90 people out of 100 don't report their encounter in any way. And that number goes way up when you talk about, you know, an extensive encounter, like, you know, face-to-face contact or an onboard experience or what have you. But the vast majority of sightings go unrecorded, and people who do report them generally tell them their closest friends, perhaps, their family. But by and large, yeah, most of this stuff is going unrecorded. So it's a real problem.
We're going to go to Elaine in Fort Myers, Florida. Good morning, Elaine. Hello?
I guess I have a dramatic thing to say where I saw aliens or anything, but I guess this is something that I wish I could get some help with. Maybe somebody could hypnotize me or I don't know. But bothering me for my whole life is I've always been very psychic and have had a lot of psychic experiences in my life, and I've always been interested in UFOs and whatever. And you know, years back, I read the Missing Time book with Whitley Strieber, and all of a sudden, when I read that, it all came back to me, where this weird thing happened to me when I was like about 5 years old. It's back up in Ohio, and I had a big family, and it was some kind of a big family gathering. At my aunt's house, and everybody was cooking and bustling around and all this stuff and whatever. It went on for hours and hours, and all of a sudden I just decided that I had to go outside, and so I did. And this makes no sense whatsoever, but I remember it as clear as day that I went outside and way across the yard I saw this mouse, this little mouse, sitting in the grass, you know, which nobody could normally see, you know, normally and everything. But I saw it, and it said, it was telling me, you know, not verbally, but just, you know, I saw it, and it just made me come there. I had to go to it. And I went across the whole lawn and whatever, went across the whole... I went, and then I put my hand down, and it crawled. It just climbed up into my hand, and then it looked at me eye to eye. And after that, I don't remember anything. Don't remember anything.
Yeah, Elaine, I think I might be tempted to go ahead and have a hypnotic regression or something with someone there in the Fort Myers area. Preston, you have stories in the book. I mean, and it's pretty common. I don't know if it's common, but it happens that people have experiences what they think are animals, like owls.
Right, right. Green memories, we call them, and it's not just animals, though that's very common. Owls, deer, rabbits, but, you know, I've got a case involving, you know, teddy bears, that's in the book, or superheroes, Mary Poppins, you know, just anything, really. Clowns, that's not unusual. And that sounds... you know, very similar. I mean, what you're describing here, like a screen memory. I wouldn't necessarily rush to hypnosis unless there was other evidence throughout your life where you had, you know, close-up sightings of UFOs or other experiences that would point towards the possibility that, you know, there are additional experiences.
Well, clowns, huh? That's as if clowns don't have a bad enough reputation. Thanks, Elaine. Thank you, Elaine, for sharing that. We're going to go to Martha in Santa Cruz. Hi, Martha.
Well, hi, both of you. This is very interesting to me. And like the lady that was speaking, I listened to your show last week and you were talking about Men in Black. I'm telling you, my father had a story all throughout my life. This was probably, late 40s, early 50s that this happened. And he later went into very high levels of law enforcement. But he was a policeman at the time, and he actually saw a UFO. And it was in the paper. We kept that. He was looking up in the sky with this other policeman. And he said it was huge here in Santa Cruz, just huge. But that the pivotal story is, I'm thinking now that they're connected. I didn't realize that what he'd seen shortly after connected. And I did not connect it with Men in Black either, but when he tells the tale, he and his buddies went up to the mountains to fish. This was about 6 months later. And they were around the fire, which he said about 11 o'clock at night. And he said literally out of the bushes and trees, these two men in black, like funeral black, walked up to the fire. And he said the weird thing was, they had glass, dark glasses on. Now it was about, when he started telling the story, I was about five, and I'm 68 now. But he said they were very pale, long hands, and he poked his buddy, and he pointed down to their feet. Now there was dust everywhere, and their shoes weren't dusty. It was the creepiest thing. They didn't speak, these two men. Very tall, very pale, very, he said, not monstrous looking, but strange looking. And they didn't speak at all. They were there about maybe 15 minutes in front of the fire. And then they turned and they walked into the bush. And he said, I think they disappeared. I don't know, but it was just strange. And we looked at each other. He said it was a sense of foreboding and evil. And he said, let's get the heck out of here. So they left. So I thought I would tell you that because it does link to the Men in Black.
So why did your dad share that experience with you? How old were you? You said you were five at the time, but how old were you when he told you?
I was five or six when it happened, probably in my teens, about 10 years later. And he would tell other people. He didn't know what it was. He's been dead about 10 years. But he would know now. I mean, he would link that up. And finally, that last week when you were talking about Men in Black, I connected the two and realized that's what he was seeing.
Was there any communication? Did they say anything?
They didn't say a word. They just stood there looking at them.
Martha, thank you for sharing that. Preston, do MIB show up in many of your cases?
No. No, I don't have a whole lot of those really at all. I'm not sure why. Some, you know, government interference, but that sounds more like the typical MIB, which are not, you know, normal government agents.
That sounds like something else. Yeah. Martha, thanks for sharing that with us. Try to get one more call in. First time caller, Chris in Durham. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys.
Welcome. You're on with Preston Dennett.
Yeah, hi. I've been trying to piece together this experience I've had since I was a little kid, and I'm just trying to figure out if there's like a central database that might have information where I could correlate. But basically, when I was about, I'd say, either 5 or 6 years old, I lived at this house in Spencer Circle in Ohio, and I remember playing out across the street in the neighbor's yard, and I was just in my own world, and I saw something out of the corner of my eye, and I looked up, and I saw this massive object. The only way I can describe it is like, you know, when you see water getting ready to drip out of the faucet, how it sort of hovers there. Well, it had that kind of wavy, sort of metallic consistency to it.
Chris, just to let you know, we got about 2 minutes in the program left.
Okay, thanks. so, you know, I watched this thing, and it stopped right up above me, and I was like, wow, what is that? Anyways, to speed it up, it wasn't until, like, many years later that I was reading some things where I realized, oh, that was a UFO. So my question is how do I find information of, because I have a rough estimate of time of when I saw this. There's a place that you can go where you can look up, okay, there were a whole bunch of sightings during this period of time in
right.
this area.
Preston, what do you tell people like Chris who had that kind of a question?
Yeah, there's absolutely resources. There are a number of UFO reporting sites that you can search their databases for sightings in a particular area at a particular time, like MUFON, that's a great database, or NUFORC, the National UFO Reporting Center. Both have databases like this, which are very helpful in finding corroboration of a person's sighting.
And Chris, you can send us an email, and we can direct you to other resources if you want, as long as you have a general time period. Thank you for that call. Preston, Dennett, it's a pretty interesting book, Inside UFOs. We only touched on some of the stories that you include in this, but it's pretty good work. I appreciate you being here.
Hey, thanks very much.
We'll talk to you again. Thanks also to Leslie Kane, talking about her book, Surviving Death, and to my colleagues there at Coast, Nathan Staton, Donna Walker, Dan Galanti, our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, and our producer, Chris Boros. George Norrie is back tomorrow night with Annie Jacobson talking about government psychic spies. Good night, everyone.